NHPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Earlier this year, when the House was crafting its budget, it held four public hearings around the state to take input from Granite Staters. Senate budget writers, on the other hand, have hosted one such gathering held yesterday at the State House. The hearing went long into the afternoon and evening as dozens of people made their case for increased funding for a variety of programs, from mental health services to support for domestic violence victims. Senate leaders have already said they feel the House's budget is too expansive. In fact, they say it has a $300 million hole in it, and so they say there's no way the Senate version can be that generous. Meanwhile, this week, the House took issue with a major Senate initiative, a bill adding casino gambling to the state. House members have been taking a long, close look at this proposal, and yesterday, three special subcommittees gave their input, suggesting some big changes to what the Senate crafted. Meanwhile, there was major news far outside the State House this week that caught attention here in the Granite State. A former top official with the New Hampshire Catholic Diocese is under investigation for possible financial wrongdoing. And on Capitol Hill, New Hampshire's two U.S. senators fought a losing battle against the internet sales tax. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and we'll catch up on the top stories of the week. Let's hear from you, too. What are some of the topics that have been on your mind this week? Where do you want more information or want to make a point about some of the major news that we've been looking at? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. Our guests this week are Dan Tuohy, state editor for Patch.com. Patch is a network of news sites with 12 in New Hampshire. And Dan, nice to see you. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Also with us, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, thanks for being here.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Kevin Landrigan, longtime political reporter for the Telegraph of Nashua and lead writer for the lobbynh.com. And Kevin, thanks for your time. I know it's been a busy week.
Great to be back, Laura.
Well, and Kevin, to you first. So the Senate held its big public hearing where it allows members of the public to come in and say what they think about the budget. As we've talked about before, Kevin, the House held four hearings all around the state. How come the Senate just held one?
I think part of it is the time frame that they have. It's not a broad open window for them to put this budget together. So I think that was one of the main reasons why House Speaker Hillary Nerelli, who became Speaker after a two-year hiatus, really wanted to demonstrate that she wanted to take the budget to the people and had a number of hearings in Nashua, Whitefield, all over the state. This is kind of old hand for Chuck Morse, who's the veteran chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. He's done this before. He's done the roadshows before. He knows how to do this job. He wants to hear from the public, and certainly did over more than 4 hours.
Yeah, what was it like over there yesterday, Kevin?
Yeah, it's interesting in that, as you pointed out in the opening here, the message from Senator Morse is the cupboard's not bare, but the cupboard's not full. And they project as much as a $300 million hole, not to get into the weeds here, but they essentially say $250 million of that hole is an overestimation by the House and by the governor of how much money is going to be received from hospitals. So as a result, Senator Morse was saying before the hearing, I like LCHIP. I like programs for domestic violence. I think we ought to increase our investments in mental health care, but we may not be able to do all this, particularly when we're against all tax increases. But I can tell you, during those more than 4 hours on Thursday night, he didn't get any suggestions on how to cut spending.
Yeah.
He got all kinds of suggestions on how to maintain spending or how to increase spending, and some really compelling, riveting stories from folks, victims of domestic violence, folks who've struggled with severe developmental impairments and have been benefited by the state and their services, to hear clients talk about their personal care attendant who helps bathe them, dress them, get them ready to eat, hasn't had a pay raise in 7 years, and they're there to say they deserve something from
wow.
the state.
So some really heartbreaking personal stories, and I read some of those this morning. And yet, Dan Tuohy, $250 million is a big, big hole. Actually, $300 million, according to Senator Morse. What were some of the thoughts that people had yesterday about that, about this sort of huge perception gap between the House version and the Senate version? 300 million is a lot.
It is, absolutely, Laura. There's always a perception gap between the House and the Senate
sure.
when it comes to the budget. The different set of revenue estimates coming in. The 300 million really reflects it's the Medicaid Enhancement Tax, the MET, M-E-T, which is a 5.5% tax charged against patient services at these hospitals, less, you know, debt and all, and charity services and whatnot. It'll be interesting to see how this this is going to be battled out in committee of conference in June at some point. It's going to be drastically different budget. I mean, talking about 300 million, but I don't think that it really came up, as Kevin mentioned. It was people talking about what they want, like restore funds cut last session, not new funds, restore funds. And we'll see, you know, whether it's domestic violence services, you know, the wait list for developmentally disabled. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And it's really the people coming out last night, you know, bravo to them. They were really well-spoken, emotional, pointed, really their own best lobbyist.
Yeah. And Dean Spiliotis, what's the political element behind this?
It's really the same issue we've been talking about for several weeks now as we've talked about the Senate work on the budget. It's the issue of spending cuts versus revenue increases. So, you know, the House budget had this 30-cent increase in the cigarette tax and a 12-cent increase in the gas tax. And Senator Moore said, well, the Senate's not accepting any tax increases. So that draws a pretty deep line in the sand there. Neither the House budget nor the Senate budget has the casino gambling money in it. And as Kevin was detailing, there are a lot of very difficult choices to be made. Morse has said something like 60 state agencies have asked for either maintaining funding or increased revenue, and we hear the very difficult stories every 2 years about this time. So the political story is the same one it's been all along. What about the casino gambling revenue? And are we gonna cut back spending of this $11 billion budget, or are we gonna increase tax revenues in some way? You know, in the end, we really have to wait and see what happens in the conference committee meetings in June. But it's a standard fiscal story, spending versus tax increases.
Right, Rao. And we will definitely talk about the gambling in just a minute, because the House has been going over that in deep, deep detail. But let me also invite our listeners to join us. Let's hear what you think about all this. Our number for you to join us here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and we're looking this hour at some of the top stories of the week. We're starting off by looking at the big public hearing held on the state Senate's budget yesterday. We'd love your thoughts on that, especially if you were at the hearing. Also, we're going to take a look in just a moment at the House's examination of the Senate's casino bill. We want your thoughts on that as well, of course. The number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. And Kevin Landrigan, just to wrap up this budget story, so what happens next here?
Well, the Senate Finance Committee is going to spend the next couple of weeks going through all the spending that was approved in the House and decide up or down whether they can support it. But as we've pointed out, Senator Chuck Morse is one of the two biggest proponents of this casino. So there isn't any doubt that while he's putting this budget together, he's got one eye on his work product and one eye on what the House is going to do with the casino. Because if the House were to endorse, the House Super Committee that's now working on it, were to endorse a casino, that would enable him to put $80 million in and restore some of that spending that Dan talked about. If the gambling bill goes south in the House committee, he's got to build a budget without it, and you're looking at significant cuts.
And Dan, you mentioned the hospitals, and again, 250 of this $300 million gap that Senator Moore sees has to do with what you explained is a hospital tax. Could the hospitals sort of step in and save the day here and say, yep, you know what, we'll pay this, we're good with that?
You know, I'm not sure if they really have a say in that. I mean, of course they have a say, but I'm not sure that's an option. I think it's two different interpretations of what that tax will deliver in as far as revenues.
I see. So, yeah, Kevin.
Yeah, one of the things that's interesting here is we know the hospitals have sued the state and federal court regarding the level of Medicaid reimbursement. And sort of in the background here for a number of weeks, we've been hearing conflicting stories about whether there are active negotiations between the governor's office and the hospitals to try and reach an out-of-court settlement. If that were to happen, and I'm not saying it will, but if that were to happen, that could certainly lead to also an agreement on a Medicaid enhancement tax level that hospitals are willing to support over what they're now spending. As Governor Haslam makes this point kind of forcefully, which is as you raise how much hospitals pay in the Medicaid enhancement tax, they start getting some of their money back. And we know prior to this current budget, the hospitals were pretty much always made whole under this Medicaid enhancement tax. They pay a tax. It's a nice legal kind of three-card Monty game that we play in order to generate a bunch of federal money, and the hospitals get their money back. Well, this current budget took all the hospital money away. Governor Haslam's budget that she proposed in February, yes, would have required hospitals to pay more in MET, but also would have given them more than $50 million back in revenue.
And the broader context here in terms of Obamacare is expansion of the Medicaid system within the state. States are given the opportunity to expand Medicaid. The federal government will pay 100% for the first 3 years and I think 90% after that. And so there has been this kind of larger debate in the country about whether or not states should take this money because you're essentially committing yourself to kind of an expanded provision of benefits. And what we saw, and we've talked about this before, is that a number of states, including Republican governors who had said they were not going to take that money, have now said, we'll take it for the first 3 years, they're funded at 100%, and we'll see how it goes.
Although from what I understand, Dean, and please correct me if I'm wrong, the way the Affordable Care Act is written, can they do that sort of opt out? I think someone had told me, no, once you're in, you're in. You can't really stick one toe in and then pull it back out.
That I'm not 100% sure about, so I don't want to say one way or the other. But I do know I've heard several Republican governors, John Kasich of Ohio, Rick Scott of Florida, who said that was their plan. Now, whether or not there has now been some sort of wording in the bill that prevents that, I'm not sure.
All right. Well, after a break, let's tackle this gambling story head on, talk about how it has been looked at in great detail this week by the House, and the House members have had lots of ideas about how to change what the Senate has done. We'll talk about that in just a quick minute. We also want your input at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org, and we'll be right back.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. NHPR is giving away two tickets to see Sir Paul McCartney at Fenway Park. Your donation now to support NHPR automatically enters you to win. Public radio works when the people who use it help to pay for it. Pay for the listening you do, win a chance to see a rock legend, and take a look at the contest details at nhpr.org. Support for NHPR comes from You Are Members and from Gripponi Auto Group, featuring multiple lines of fuel-efficient, environmentally friendly cars at Gripponi Auto Junction in Bow and online 24 hours a day at gripponi.com. From New Hampshire Orthopedic Center, keeping bodies in motion on the web at nhoc.com. And Windows and Doors by Brownell, featuring energy-efficient Marvin products for your replacement or new construction project. Showroom at the Powerhouse Mall, West Lebanon. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're looking at the top stories that Granite Staters were talking about this week, including the Senate's public hearing on the budget yesterday. As we've heard from our guests, it went long into the evening with lots of folks making compelling cases for more state spending. But state senators said the budget is tighter than what House members have believed, so there'll be some tough decisions there. Join us with your questions and comments on that if you'd like. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. Our roundtable today includes Kevin Landergan with the Telegraph of Nashua and thelobbynh.com, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, and Dan Tuohy, state editor for Patch.com. And Dan, let's start with you and talk about this gambling bill in the House. Boy, they're really getting granular over there, if I could put it that way. I mean, they're looking at this thing in great detail.
They are, Laura. They have a fine-tooth comb, if you will. The big news we found out yesterday, the super committee, as Kevin mentioned, it's the Joint Committee of House Finance and Ways and Means, very long title. It's set to vote this out of committee on Wednesday, May 15th, which is quite an aggressive time schedule because, frankly, they have to. I mean, the time's running short here this session. But what that means is going to be possibly a slew of amendments to this bill, which are due on Tuesday. And some of the changes that were presented yesterday at subcommittee findings included, you know, reworking some of the license requirements, having greater oversight, reworking the revenue distribution system. And the thing that struck me as well, Neil Kirk, one of the committee chairmen, was pointing out that you know, the AG's office says they need more time to review the regulations for RFPs, and this would add another 11 months onto the timeline before a license fee could be granted. And that's 11 months for a review of the regulations and another 2 months for background checks.
Background checks into who did.
Right, for applicants and all those that would be involved.
I see, yeah. And it was pretty impressive the way Speaker Norelli decided to really go into the detail of this. Just remind us how she's going about this, Dan. I mean, she's got separate committees looking at the regulations and the money and the social costs, and then they're all doing their work, and then they're reporting to a super committee. Why is Speaker Norelli doing it this way?
Well, I think she, you know, as you said, you want to make sure everything was done properly and really flesh this bill out. It's a significant bill, a lot of legalese, and let's not forget, we don't have a framework in New Hampshire for legalized casino gambling. So they're not trying to, on one hand, they're doing something altogether new, but they're always trying to look at, like, Massachusetts, what they've done and other states have done for their regulatory framework. And Speaker Norelli, of course, created three subcommittees. It's the Revenue Regulations and Community Impact. And the other speaker yesterday was Representative Pat Lovejoy of Stratham, really going into social costs of what this bill would be. Nothing, I guess, too surprising given some of the testimony we've heard over the past couple of weeks. But, I mean, she was talking about problem gaming, you name it. And I where I was sitting in the room yesterday, I was looking across at one of the sponsors who sits on the committee, one of the bill sponsors of the casino bill, and he was just, you know, kind of shaking his head like, well, this is obviously contesting some of the things she was having to say. But I think Pat Lovejoy's testimony really spoke to a lot of people that don't think this bill is a good idea.
Well, and you could say that Speaker Norelli, Kevin Landergan, is trying to flesh this out, or you could say she's trying to slow it down. You know, there's a lot of detail, as Dan said, and the ideas that were put forward yesterday by these three special subcommittees were extremely detailed and made a lot of changes.
Yeah, the I give props to House Speaker Norelli on this, really, because while she says right now she's kind of neutral on the issue, she has a 20-year history of opposing expanded gambling. So I think there was every expectation when the Senate moved quickly here that the House might take a confrontational tone. And Speaker Norelli has not done that. And I think it's both a credit to her, and it speaks to her relationship with new Governor Maggie Hassan, a former Senate Majority Leader. They worked well together when they were both legislative leaders. She's trying to give Governor Hassan the best shot of getting a casino bill by putting the super committee together. That improves the shot. Why? The Ways and Means Committee, where this bill would have gone, is almost 3-1 against expanded gambling. So by creating this super committee, you collect more gambling supporters in the pool, and you give it at least an opportunity to get there. Now, what's important to remember is a lot of folks want a casino, but they want it under their terms. And that's what we saw this week. Many of these changes that are being proposed by the super committee are non-starters with Senate Republicans in particular. What are they? Well, for one thing, all the revenue in this emerging House proposal would go to the general fund, to the state treasury. That's just what Senate Republicans don't want with a casino. They do not want to create a cash cow.
Yeah, they've got more specific ideas. It'll go to X amount to roads, X amount to the North Country, and so forth.
And X amount to higher education as well. Much like the lottery, where all the profits go to education.
Sure.
They want to create a dedicated source so it does not become a continuing demand for more and more money from the casino.
The number for you to join us again is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. We're taking your questions and comments in our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup at 1-800-892-6477. Dan, go ahead and jump in real quick, and then Dean, I have a question for you, too.
Yes, just that everyone's trying to read the tea leaves here on where this bill is going. As Kevin mentioned, there are people that have a long history of opposing this, including the Speaker, including Mary Jane Waldner, the chairman of the chairwoman of the Super Committee. Neil Kirk has a record of voting against it. But also, one point that struck me yesterday when I was looking over the bill again, there are 14 sponsors of SB 152, the main casino gambling bill. 9 of them are state senators. So in the Senate, you have that majority, that 13 senator majority. So you have 9 of the 13 already are on board and they're willing to do something to make this work.
Yeah. One last question for you, Dean. And I've done dozens of shows on gambling in my many years hosting this program, but I've never seen a proposal like this being used so politically in terms of our earlier conversation on the budget. I mean, it's really kind of either or. And it's being used in a strong way.
It really is quite remarkable. You know, a month or two ago, we were talking at kind of a general level about whether or not this $80 million licensing fee would be available for budget writers. And now we've gotten to a level of detail in the analysis of what this will actually mean for the state. You see how complicated it is, how many balls are up in the air at the same time being juggled. It's almost a little bit like kind of like a game of dominoes where you sort of push on one domino and you see where the kind of ripples of dominoes fall. You know, for example, there have been this concern that the Millennium venue was going to be kind of a slots barn that was going to be outdone by these big mega casinos in Massachusetts. So they've upped the ante now with this $650 million facility. It looks sort of like a New England version of the Grand Floridian Resort at Disney World, if you saw some of the pictures in the newspaper. So, you know, they've upped the ante. And then there are all these other concerns about, well, now they're going to have an entertainment venue. What does that mean for other similarly sized entertainment venues in the region? You know, they're going to have all these construction jobs and full-time jobs. If it's on the Massachusetts border, how do we assure that New Hampshire residents get some percentage of those jobs? So it's political kind of in the general sense in terms of revenue, but we're now getting to the point where it's really political, as Kevin was saying, for kind of all different groups and constituencies within the state. And it just has become a very kind of complex, necessary problem, I think. But as you and I said, you and I have been talking about this for many years. We've never had these kinds of discussions before about what it would actually mean for very specific groups of people within the state.
That's right. That's what I was trying to express. I've never seen it expressed so clearly.
There's never been a reason to, because we knew it was never going to get this far. And now they're actually, I think, because it is a possibility, you have to do this kind of work. But it is remarkable the extent to which all these sort of competing threads are now being pulled by different constituencies.
And we haven't had in a long time a governor who was so out front and really
promoting
this.
Right. This has been sort of a long time and coming.
Well, again, I want to invite you to join us with your questions and comments on some of the top stories of the week. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and you can join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, I want to turn to two stories that made headlines this week concerning New Hampshire's natural world. Sam Evans Brown is with us, environment reporter for NHPR. And Sam, thanks for taking some time out for us this morning.
Thank you, Laura.
Well, Governor Hassan this week, Sam, wrote a letter to the governor of Connecticut regarding renewable energy and specifically the Northern Pass, talking about New England's renewable energy goals. Just give us a little background there, first of all. Why should Governor Hassan care about what the governor of Connecticut does in terms of renewable energy?
Right. This is this is something that's been brewing for a long time. Connecticut has some very aggressive renewable goals. They want 20% of their electricity to be coming from renewable sources by 2020. And they're worried that they're going to bump up against that limit, and that's going to cost their ratepayers extra, because if you don't make those goals, you're required to pay what's called alternative compliance payments. So what they've done is they've established a rule that will enact sort of a trigger that if they hit those limits, then you can start to count. They've created a new class of renewable energy called Class 1A, and it's basically Canadian hydropower. And if they hit those limits, they can start to count Canadian hydro as getting them toward their renewable goals. It's been sort of a long legislative process down in Connecticut. There are a lot of opponents to this, a lot of groups that say Canadian hydropower is already a mature technology and doesn't need any additional support from the government, say that this is just something that's totally unnecessary. But, you know, the folks down in Connecticut don't want to see their electric rates go up because they're not making their renewable goals. So
what's New Hampshire's interest in this?
Well, of course, it's when we talk about Canadian hydropower, we're talking about Northern Pass. It's not necessarily 100% clear that this would directly benefit Northern Pass, but a lot of people see it that way. In fact, there was an investing research group that, after the bill passed through the Senate, upgraded the stock of Northern Utilities from, sort of neutral to buy because they saw this as so positive. Other investment groups have seen that as sort of maybe a little optimistic, but it's worth noting that folks assume that this can benefit Northern Pass by giving them a stable contract that they can create with the Connecticut government, that they'll be selling their power at a fixed price, an insured return on that investment.
Interesting. And yet Northern Pass, as you well know, Sam, isn't a done deal. Part of the problem, as you have been reporting, is that some in New Hampshire don't want this coming through the state to be put on the New England grid. Now, we shouldn't say the whole state, but there is strong opposition.
And it is worth noting that this change does not help in any way overcome the siting problems that Northern Pass has been facing. The opposition and the sort of the chess game that's being played remains the same. What it could possibly do is give the developers of the project a little bit extra wherewithal to see it through, because they think that, we could get one of these contracts with Connecticut.
So what did Governor Hassan specifically say to the governor of Connecticut?
She basically just asked him to oppose the changes. She asked him to veto the bill. It's already, it's pretty unlikely that's going to happen. Immediately, the chief of staff from the Connecticut governor said, we see this as a win-win for Connecticut and the region. It's the governor's pet bill. It was rushed through the Senate and rushed over to the House right away. They're awaiting a vote in the Connecticut House of Representatives.
So that's what happens next on this. They're awaiting a vote in Connecticut. And despite New Hampshire's protests, sounds like it'll go through.
It will probably go through.
But it does not change what you called very accurately, Sam, the siting problems that Northern Pass has faced here in New Hampshire. And I understand we keep seeing deadlines moving forward. They're going to come out with a new route by X date, and then X date changes to another date and another date and another date. What's the latest date?
I believe we're back into July. I'm actually not 100% sure about that. But the concern is now that they're going to have to look for special easements through conservation lands. That's what the opponents have been saying. Of course, Northern Pass spokesmen have no comment on that issue.
Another environmental story, real quick, I'd love for you to catch us up on, Sam, has to do with the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, better known as REGGIE. The New Hampshire legislature this week to move toward possibly lowering the cap on greenhouse gas emissions. In other words, tightening up the amount of greenhouse gases that New Hampshire utilities can pump out. How come?
Well, since REGGIE was designed and the caps that they had in place were set, we've seen sort of the historic shift in the amount of natural gas that America produces, and the fuel switching and energy efficiency efforts that have been happening just weren't foreseen by the designers of REGGIE. So if you know how the program works, power plants are required to buy allowances for emitting CO2. And there are just too many allowances out there. The price of them, they're trading about $2.80 a ton. That's just about as low as it can get. And so they're looking to increase the cost of those allowances. They're going to take the unsold ones out of the market, and they're going to lower the cap on how many are released. And so, law of supply and demand, if you have a lower supply of these allowances, the cost will go up because the demand is about the same.
All right. Sam, thank you very much for taking a couple minutes out of your morning for us. We appreciate it. All right. That's Sam Evans-Brown, again, updating us on a couple big environmental stories this week. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in the Exchange, and you can join us 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And, gentlemen, let's go first to Rich in Woodstock. Hi, Rich. You're on the air. Go ahead. Rich in Woodstock, you're on the air. Go ahead. And we lost Rich in Woodstock. I hope you call back, Rich. The phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Email again is exchange@nhpr.org. And let's try Johnny in Manchester. Hi, Johnny. Go ahead. You're on the Exchange.
Good morning.
Morning.
Hi. My question had to do with the all the amendments happening to the possible casino bill. We have entertainment complexes all over the state that are kind of flipping out and trying to control they want to amend the size of what type of entertainment complex can come in with the casino. And I find it curious because I've never seen anything else regulated in the state like that. We have free market with the supermarkets. One comes in bigger than the other, and the other one closes down. And yet we have venues as giant as the Verizon Center worried about the size of the entertainment complexes. And in Manchester, you hear similar talk. The Palace and the Verizon both want to keep sort of competition away. But yet you look at a town like Portsmouth, and there's lots of theater groups and lots of companies. It's not just the music hall. And as this city and as the state continues to bring in, as people continue to come here, I just think it's kind of odd that you would control where people's free spending dollars are going. You know, we don't want to keep the venue too big, and we don't want it to compete with anything. I just find it fascinating that it became a legitimate talking point and still a point of concern in this state.
Well, yeah, let's talk about
that. Entertainment.
You know, Johnny, let's talk about that. I'm glad you called. And we talked about this last week a little bit, but we should talk about it more. And Dan, Johnny's right. Other entertainment venues have said, you know, let's alter this casino bill so that their entertainment venue isn't as big as ours. It doesn't compete as directly with ours. Just remind us what's going on there.
Yeah, one of the earliest or first amendments we've heard about was from Pat Long, a Democrat from Manchester. And it's being called the Verizon Amendment. Essentially, they're trying to protect or have a carve-out for not just the Verizon Wireless Arena, but for other venues existing in New Hampshire, whether it's, you know, the Capital Center for the Arts in Concord. The Music Hall has expressed concern as well, you know, the Casino Ballroom in Hampton Beach. It's an interesting question Johnny raises, because there's also a similar argument about why should there be one location for a casino. Well, I think there's a lot more support, though, for an amendment, it seems, at least from the committee, for a carve-out protecting some of these existing uses.
Yeah, it's interesting. Dean, go ahead.
Yeah, and this is the argument here essentially is that there's a finite number of entertainment dollars in the state, and that, you know, everyone's competing for that same pot of money. You know, the concern that I've heard expressed is that the casino would have an unfair advantage because Millennium has resources and funds outside of New Hampshire, so we can offer kind of prohibitive fees for acts that you typically would get at the Capital Center for the Arts or the Music Hall on the Seacoast. You know, and the issue is not just for those venues, but, you know, people go out to dinner, they do other kinds of sort of spending money downtown. So it's a concern not just for the actual venues, but for all the kinds of surrounding businesses that have a symbiotic relationship with that venue. And I think the plans that came out recently for Millennium say about 1,000 to a 1,500 seat venue, that's going to cause a lot of concern. And I saw in the news that, you know, there've already been, the Capital Center has tried to book a number of pretty big name acts that have actually gone to casinos in the region instead. So this is a legitimate concern.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Johnny, thanks for calling in. And Kevin, I might ask you to follow up after a short break on that too. I have another question. We'll take more of your calls too. Your questions and comments on our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup are welcome at 1-800-892-6477.
This is NHPR 939. Good morning. Coming up at 10, the Friday News Roundup on the Diane Rehm Show. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and the NEEF Network organizations working with the New Hampshire Department of Education to increase the college aspirations of local students at IamCollegeBound.org. And TransCanada, generating and selling electricity, and a proud supporter of New Hampshire Audubon's initiative to restore nesting bald eagles in the Connecticut River watershed. This is NHPR.
For Leadership Circle member Ben Dibble, NHPR is
part of my daily life. I listen to it in the morning on the way to work. I listen to it at home. I listen to it on the weekends. It's part of my way of life. It's one of my habits, and I adore it. The monthly Leadership Circle at $100 a month is well worth it to me.
How many times per week, per day, do you listen to NHPR? If your listening has become habitual, you can join our Leadership Circle. Find out more at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Monday in The Exchange, the state of New Hampshire's economy. Email us your take on how well our economy is doing at exchange@nhpr.org, and then be sure to join us Monday morning live at 9. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and you can join our conversation 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. We want your thoughts, questions, comments, and some of the top stories that we're looking at from the Senate's public hearing on the budget and the House's hard look at a Senate casino bill. We've also caught up on a couple environmental stories with Sam Evans Brown, including Governor Hassan writing a letter to the governor of Connecticut regarding renewable energy, Northern Pass, and also the legislature moving toward possibly lowering the caps under REGI, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. Your questions and comments are welcome. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Kevin Landrigan, just before the break, we were talking about Johnny's comments. He was saying, look, those other entertainment venues who want special carve-outs under the casino bill so that they don't have to compete with entertainment at a potential casino. He's saying, look, let the free market decide. Why do they get special exemptions? Dean Spiliotis was sort of explaining how it's a little more complicated than that, and I know you want to jump in.
Yeah, I just wanted to say a couple of things. One, Millennium Gaming's proposal that they unveiled this week, their redesign with an entertainment complex of no more than 1,500 seats, was right at Verizon, because the Verizon Amendment says the casino can't have a facility with more than 1,500 seats. So they were trying to meet Verizon's demand. The thing you have to remember about entertainment venues at casinos is, one, they won't pay market prices for a performer to come there. They will pay above market prices. Why? Because they want customers there to gamble. Many times these music performances are lost leaders for casinos. They don't make money on the performance. They make money on, as Dean said, the ancillary things people do after the performance. The other thing about casinos in many states, in most states, I should say, is that performers have to sign exclusivity agreements. So I will not perform anywhere else in the state within a certain period of time. In some states, it's up to a year. In other states, it's up to 6 months. That's the kind of chilling effect that it could have on the Capitol Center, the Music Hall, the Colonial Theater in Keene. One thing that isn't really well known, but it's very clear by talking to folks who run these smaller venues, is they already cooperate among each other in almost a market protection sort of way. In other words, okay, Music Hall, you get Katie Lang this year, I'll take Pat Benatar this year over at the Palace Theater. Next year, I get Katie Lang and you get Pat Benatar. They cooperate a great deal in order to fill up all of their venues.
All right. Well, again, Johnny, thanks for the call. It's a good point, obviously. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. And let's go back to our callers, gentlemen. Michael's waiting in Pittsfield. Hi, Michael. You're on the air. Go ahead. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. With Washington talking about money's lacking in Medicaid funds, is that DISH money, when they started that DISH money, and that would include taxing the elderly in the nursing homes, is that a scam going on or what?
Thanks for the question, Michael. And boy, this DISH money, Kevin, is disproportionate share. It's hospitals. Without getting too much into the swamp, just remind us how this works.
Right. Michael raises an interesting point and something that Washington has been watching for years. And for the last President Obama is the third president to try and ratchet down these disproportionate share payments. They are intended to compensate states and hospitals for free or reduced care in their facilities, actually lost profits, if you will. But states have use these disproportionate share payment formulas in order to generate massive amounts of federal support. So under Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, disproportionate share payments to states dramatically get reduced. By 2018, the estimate is New Hampshire will lose at least 50% of its disproportionate share payment.
Now, the argument on the other side of that, Kevin, correct me if I'm wrong, is that if more people have coverage, then hospitals won't be providing all this charity care. They'll be getting paid for it.
That's correct.
So that's the argument on the other
side.
Yeah,
that's the argument. There isn't going to be the need for this free care makeup call that Washington has been doing now for about 15 years.
Well, and Michael, it's a great question, and I'm going to leave aside any more detail at this point, but I do want to let you know that we're watching this healthcare bill very closely, and we'll probably be following up in a couple weeks or months on some of these financial impacts that you talk about. So thank you for that. I did want to ask you all about a couple more stories outside of the New Hampshire State House, and the internet sales tax, gentlemen. And maybe I can turn to you first, Dean Spiliotis. Why is this so controversial in New Hampshire?
Well, because we don't have a sales tax, and it would require internet firms in the state who do business to collect tax and then send that tax to the state in which the shoppers are doing the purchasing. Yeah, this is a bill in Congress. The Senate just passed it 69-27. It's not
without the votes of Shaheen and Hayat.
It's not supported by actually in the House as well. None of our congressional delegation supports this, which is no great surprise. So, you know, current law requires that retailers collect the sales tax if the store has a physical location in the state only. So under the new law, everybody would have to collect sales tax and send it to the state where the purchasing is taking place. You know, this is a very interesting story. You know, Amazon had been a big opponent of this for many years, and then they decided to build more physical warehouses so that they could increase the speed of delivery. So now they've already started collecting taxes in those states where they have physical locations. So, you know, clearly this is something the four states in the country who do not have sales taxes, including New Hampshire, don't want this. Kelly Ayotte has been very vocal about it. Jean Shaheen has said she's going to introduce an amendment to exempt New Hampshire from this. You know, there is in the bill an exemption that says if you're below $1 million, you're exempt from this. You know, Kelly Ayotte's argument is, well, okay, you're going to have a lot of companies in New Hampshire who are not going to want to expand because they don't want to hit that $1 million level. So it really is kind of a disincentive to business development. So President Obama supports this.
I mean, the tide really seems to be against New Hampshire.
Right. Anytime you get anything bipartisan in the Senate, you can certainly say safely at this point that the tide is turning. You know, the House has a majority. The Republicans have a majority in the House. There's a conservative group there that views any tax as a tax increase. So there probably will be more pushback, but this might very well pass.
Well, thanks for that update. Sure. And it's been real interesting. It's made a lot of headlines, and I've gotten lots of emails about it. Speaking of Senator Ayotte, Dan Toohey, to you, the fallout continued this week over Senator Ayotte's vote against expanded background checks for gun purchases. Now, we talked about this last week. There were radio ads. There were a lot of letters to the editor. There was a lot of activity on social media around this. This past week, Dan, the senator herself wrote some long op-ed pieces explaining her vote, saying the criticism is from out-of-state gun control groups. Why does this continue?
Well, I think she's hearing it from all sides here. People saying, you know, of course, Second Amendment rights folks are saying, good for you. But that last week when she was in the district, had those town hall meetings and had the Newtown victim's daughter challenge her and confront her, that really got a lot of people focused on the issue. If they weren't already focused, they were focused on it right then. And even back last week, the NRA had some radio ads in the state supporting, you know, good for you, Senator Ayotte. And this is why she voted against that particular expanded background check bill. And this week, of course, the big news is the NRA took out a $25,000 buy from WMUR for TV ads. And I don't think it's going to stop for a little while here.
Really?
Apparently, there's a couple of conservative groups out there as well coming to her support, including Senator Marco Rubio. He put out a couple of emails, requests us on Twitter yesterday saying, you know, donate to Kelly Ayotte. So there's a lot of people that are us versus them type of a format or debate here.
Kevin?
Yeah, and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid sort of turned up the heat on Kelly Ayotte, not by accident, during his weekly briefing with reporters from Nevada when he said, I think there are going to be some changes, some flips on this universal background check bill, and Kelly Ayotte may be the leading candidate, according to what I'm being told. And of course, Senator Ayotte's office put out a pretty terse statement that Senate Majority Reid does not speak for Senator Ayotte. She's not changed her position. But there is no question that this is going to continue to be a real lightning rod, and mainly because this background check bill is coming back in some form in the Senate. And I think there were five Democrats who opposed the universal background check in the Senate. They're working. Senator Reid is working on that group as well and acknowledges, I've got to change some minds there for it to pass.
Dean, real quick.
Yeah, two things jump out at me here. You know, I remember Senator Ayotte right after Newtown saying two things. One, that she wasn't sure about the need for expanded background check legislation, that we need to reform the existing system, and two, that there needed to be a greater focus on mental health. She's still essentially saying the same thing. So if nothing else, for all the flack she's getting, she has been consistent. It's just that the environment has changed somewhat. The second thing that was interesting to me this week is a new narrative emerged from her. I heard Senator Ayotte say that the problem with these town hall meetings is that the national media was not reporting the extent to which there's actually support for her position, that essentially the national media came in, they don't understand New Hampshire's political context, the sort of, you know, gun culture, libertarian culture, and they focused on these one or two high-profile moments, the daughter of the deceased principal, I believe, from Newtown, rather than what she says at these town meetings was a fair bit of support for her. So she says she's not going to back down, and you know, so far I take her at her word.
Well, I want to ask you you guys about another story that made headlines earlier this week, and the headline was from Maryland, but Kevin Landrigan, it had to do with New Hampshire. A former top official with the New Hampshire Catholic Church, Monsignor Edward Arsenault, now under investigation. Now, Kevin, there's not a lot of information out there, but let's just do what we can with this story.
Yeah, well, Father Ed Arsenault, now Monsignor Arsenault, the Vatican made him a Monsignor in 2010. When folks may not remember this, but when Bishop McCormick essentially became a radioactive personality because of the priest scandal and his involvement in it when he was with the Archdiocese of Boston.
Yeah, and people said he didn't do enough.
Exactly.
Not that he was involved himself, but that he didn't do enough. He let priests who'd been abusive kind of pass through the system.
Yes. Father Ed Arsenault really became the face of the diocese. He was the chancellor of the diocese. He was the spokesman for them. He worked aggressively with then-Attorney General Kelly Ayotte on an auditing regimen in the future to determine what happens with the Catholic Church with regard to priests and their transference and how they're transferred to different dioceses and the like. I happen to have a personal connection to Father Ed, I should mention. I mean, my wife and I moved to Concord in 2003, I was a parishioner at St. Pius in Manchester, and he became the pastor at that church after the pastor who was there left due to indiscretions. A very charismatic figure, extremely good fundraiser, very erudite, very articulate, but also had this kind of common man quality. He'd wear Hawaiian shirts at flea markets. He'd joke all the time about battling his own bulge, and it made him a very likable figure. This is shocking to Catholics
all over New
Hampshire.
Do we know what it's about, Kevin? Really, I mean, it keeps saying financial wrongdoing, but it doesn't say any more
And perhaps inappropriate adult relationship. So the speculation has been that somehow perhaps church expenses were used to either further that inappropriate adult relationship, but we're really in the dark here. And the bishop has said we're going to this investigation is going to treat with the light of day, but we have not seen a lot of light shed on the details
right.
of this.
Okay, and I'm sure we'll be following up in later roundtables as we go forward. And I did want to follow up on one or two other stories if we have time. You know, guys, last week we talked about the 10-year anniversary of the old man falling. This week, there's a proposal to build a new monument to another New Hampshire icon, if I could put it that way, Dean Spiliotis. Some folks, a bipartisan group, which is always encouraging, wants to raise money to build a monument to the New Hampshire primary.
Yeah, well, you know, we have at the State Library right now, there is the historical marker and granite pathway where you can sort of walk along the history of the New Hampshire primary. It's a fun thing to do. And, yeah, this is a bipartisan group. You got a Democrat, Jim Demers, who was a co-chair of Obama's campaigns in 08 and 12. You've got Jim Merrill, who ran Romney's campaign in 08 and was a co-chair in New Hampshire in 12. And so the heads of the parties, so everybody, these people who are sort of, you know, typically at each other's throats politically, have all kind of banded together to raise money to update and, I guess, beautify this particular historical marker because the primary is so central to our political culture here. Yeah, so you can see it right outside the State Library. It kind of runs along the ground, and I guess they want to update it and expand it. It's a nice idea for anybody who's into the primary.
Although it comes at a time, Dean, when lots of people are saying the New Hampshire primary really isn't that important anymore.
Yeah, well, we can do another whole show on that.
Opening a can of worms here, but
a minute 30 left of the show. I don't want to open that can of worms, but you know, I think think it will continue to be a key part of our culture, whether the rest of the country recognizes it or not. We have that debate every 4 years, and I'm sure we'll be talking about that not too long from now.
All right, real quick, Dan Toohey, former U.S. Senator Judd Gregg may have a new job. According to Bloomberg News, he's a leading candidate to run the biggest lobbying group for Wall Street, a group called the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association. Now, this is just according to one source, but what might Judd Gregg bring to that job, sort of working with the head honchos on Wall Street?
Yeah, well, he comes with a lot of connections in D.C., of course, and around the country as well. He's a financial mind. He's worked on some the biggest legislation in the past 10 years, including the bailout.
The TARP bailout, right?
Right, Wall Street. Right. And, you know, he was also one time a brief nominee for Commerce. So he has an amazing resume when you look at it. I mean, from executive counsel to congressman to governor to United States senator, he has experience in a Rolodex like no other.
All right. And Dan, real quickly, next week, what are you especially going to be covering? It's going to be a big week at the State House.
Right. Casino being voted out of committee on Wednesday. And, of course, it wasn't always this way, but we'll see whether the House in the following week overturns that committee recommendation or upholds it.
Okay, so big vote on casinos next week in the House. Kevin, what are you doing next week?
Well, I'm going to be following this medical marijuana bill that obviously got changed dramatically by a Senate committee this past week. They took out what is called the homegrown option, really at the demand of Governor Hassan. Upsetting to a lot of people because then Senator Hassan voted for a homegrown medical marijuana bill. Now Governor Hassan says it's too loose. We can't regulate it. They only should be given out at dispensaries.
All right. So gambling, medical marijuana. Dean, how about you?
I'm going to watch all that, but I'm going to look at the political stuff, too. Watch Senator Ayotte continue to deal with the national spotlight. A couple of big presidential contenders, Bobby Jindal, Rand Paul in the state as well. It's starting already, and it's only 2013.
Wow. Okay. Well, we'll listen for that as well. Thank you all very much for being here. Dean, good to see you. Thank you.
Thank you, Laura.
Dean Spiliota, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. Dan Toohey, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dan Toohey, state editor for Patch.com. Patch is a network of news sites with 12 here in the Granite State. And Kevin Landrigan, wonderful to see you. Thank you.
Always fun.
Kevin Landrigan, longtime political reporter for the Telegraph of Nashua, lead writer for The Lobby, NH.com. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. The Exchange theme music was composed by Bob Lord. Our executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
Next week on The Exchange, we begin with an update on the New Hampshire economy, including where the jobs are and where they aren't. Then Granite State Muslims speak out on public attitudes and even backlash after the Boston Marathon bombings. And later, the dramatic rise in food and skin allergies in this country, especially among children. We'll explore why this is happening and how we're responding. Email us at nhpr.org and join us all next week for The Exchange, every morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. here on NHPR.
The domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup on the